Coming up today, robots hack to stab you, the painted lines changing how we queue, and Facebook's expanded its safety check. You're listening to episode 332 of the Wired UK podcast, your weekly guide to the best of science, tech, ideas, business, and design. I'm your host, Matt Burgess, and joining me today is Leah Clark.
Hello.
And Victoria Turk.
Hi.
You prefer Vicky, don't you?
Well, you know, either works.
Either works. What have you learned this week, Vicky, Victoria?
I just have a bit of an amusing fact. So obviously our friends over in North America had quite a celestial event this past week. They got to see a full eclipse.
First this century? Or first for 100 years, isn't it? Something like that.
I don't know, actually. Yeah, well, you know, they're pretty rare, depending on where you are. But yeah, so we saw lots of great pictures from them, and we all felt very jealous. But after that event, there was a spike in internet searches for terms including eclipse headache, I looked at the sun.
Oh, dear.
I accidentally looked at eclipse. And terms along those lines. So I just thought that was a bit of schadenfreude, really.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, that people were referring to it tongue-in-cheek as eclipse hypochondria.
Well, good job. They probably only come round every 100 years or so then. Otherwise, Google search results will be put completely out of whack. Leah, what did you learn this week? Did you learn anything?
I learned many things, Matt. So I'm going to be upset if everybody's heard of this before, because I hadn't and I thought it was amazing. Did you know there's something called a cookie cutter shark?
No, but yeah. It sounds cool.
Doesn't it? Why do you think it's got that name?
Has it got like a really weird mouth, like really jagged teeth?
It's because, Vicky, of the holes it gouges out of other fish, like a cookie cutter stamp.
Oh, it's to do with how it attacks fish rather than its shape.
I mean, cookie cutters can come in all shapes and sizes. It's just the fact that it uses its mouth in the manner by which we might press a scone. But it does it to a fish carcass. It's also known as the cigar shark because of the shape of its body, which
so
is
it
less
looks
exciting.
Like a cigar, but acts like a cookie cutter.
Yeah.
It's the shark that keeps on giving.
Oh, I
and
love it.
Something that I learned this week was the size of the world's largest samosa, which was 153 kilograms.
Was it made by a shark?
It was not made by a shark, unfortunately. It was made by a charity called Muslim Aid that cooked it, and it raised money, and it was given to the actual samosa one. It was cooked in like a specially created deep flat fryer. It was given to homeless people to give them some food to eat on.
I feel like that's the most dangerous thing you could try and cook on a large scale. Like deep fat, hot fat, spitting everywhere on your 153 kilo samosa. I was just saying.
Yummy though.
Not very
safe. Yeah, still try to eat it, I would think. Vicky, this week, or a couple of weeks ago maybe, you noticed something on your commute to work.
So I was getting on the tube. I actually had to... long story. There were problems on my line, so I had to redirect and take a different route, which is why I happened upon this new thing, which was strange green painted lines on the platform at King's Cross Station. So on the Victoria Underground line, heading southbound, if you go to that platform, you'll see that there's sort of a green path, and it's green vinyl that's been like laid down on the floor. And there's signs on the wall that tell you not to stop on the green path.
Well, but, you know, he was like, green path on the tube?
Yeah.
Suddenly there's a standstill at King's Cross. Why aren't they yellow?
Yeah, well, so I kind of wondered what was going on here. So I got in touch with Transport for London, TfL. And it turns out that they're running a study to try and see if having these kind of coloured markings on the platform can help encourage people to move along the platform and reduce congestion at busy times. So what normally happens, as you probably know, if you take the tube at rush hour, everyone kind of congregates near the entrance to the platform. Ugh.
No, well, not everyone.
And then they'll rush in, like, everyone tries to use their own little trick to try and work out where the doors are going to open so that they can stand just next to where the doors are going to open and then jump on.
That's normal. Come on.
Yeah, that's normal behaviour. So the idea of this trial is to try and change that behaviour.
Oh, dear.
By painting the screen line. So it's supposed to encourage you, along with the signs and the announcements, to walk down the platform, spread across it, and then the green line also boxes out areas on the platform where the doors open. But the point is, and this is the slightly confusing bit, I think, you're not supposed to stand on them. So you're supposed to walk on them, but when you're standing still waiting, you're not supposed to be on the green box.
Do they have a big cross on them? What indicates this?
Well, not so much.
TFL.
No. So, yeah, it's just the signs on the wall, and I think they have announcements.
The signs too. On the wall.
So, yeah, so they're I think they put this down about a month ago, and that they're planning to keep it there for a few months. And they're using CCTV cameras. They had some cameras there before they put the paint down to monitor passenger flow and the number of passengers going through. And now they're monitoring with the lines there to see if it has any effect.
I feel like of all the people that tend to do the worst things on the tube platforms, it's tourists who, you know, arrive at the entrance onto the platform and stand there because they don't know which way to go. And they're probably not going to understand TFL signs.
Possibly. Yeah, I mean, I think it's that dreadful mix of tourists who maybe don't really know where they're going and irate commuters who think that everyone should automatically know everything.
Green does seem an odd colour for something that you're not supposed to do.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Well, go this way. Mm-hmm. And then there should be a giant red box or something. It should look like where, you know, I'm not a driver. Those boxes you're not allowed to sit in as a car.
The yellow grids. Yeah. Yeah.
But you can't do yellow.
Well, yeah, so I actually spoke to a behavioural scientist from LSE, Dario Capan, and he's a bit sceptical about this, and he raised the same point. He said that he thinks, you know, green is maybe a bit confusing. So TFL's idea is that green means go, so you're supposed to be moving on the green. But Dario pointed out that, you know, most people think green is like a welcoming colour. It's like where you're supposed to be. And he's not convinced that it'll be obvious what you're supposed to do. And, you know, maybe he suggested maybe they should have put text on the line as well saying what you're supposed to do, because people don't necessarily look at the signs. And he basically said, you know, even if people do know what you're supposed to do, they might just not do it because people are terrible.
I mean, people... I like how you're talking like this as if you're an ideal commuter. I'm going to have to find out what your practices are, because I'm sure you've got some bad habits on the tube platform.
I try and be polite.
But there's always someone on a loudspeaker saying, please move down the platform. There's plenty of space down the other end. And everyone ignores them because they know that they want to get on a particular spot. So.
Well, so this is what Dario was saying. You know, a lot of people have this mentality of like, you know, I've paid for my ticket and, you know, I'm going to stand where I want to stand.
Oh, yeah.
So, we'll see. We should get some results in a couple months, I imagine. Although, there is a little bit of a problem because TFL pointed out to me that actually the number of trains going on that line has been increased from 32 an hour to 36 an hour. So obviously that should also reduce the congestion. So it may be a little bit tricky to pinpoint the exact results that they want to. But we'll see what happens. Who knows? Maybe the whole tube will end up painted green soon.
Yeah, it could be one of these things that just is there to subtly change our behaviours that, well, it's not that subtle, these giant green blocks, but one of these things that just is
subtly
a thing
make us lemmings.
Yeah.
Well, and you know, visual cues like that can work.
And so. TfL have tried other schemes to get people moving easily through the London Underground before, haven't they?
Two varying degrees of success. Yeah, I don't know if you remember last year, they did an experiment on the Holborn escalators.
Oh, the controversy here.
Which Londoners were moaning about for months. So basically, they, you know, normally you stand on the right on the escalator and then people walk up the left side if they're feeling energetic. But they instituted this rule whereby on the Holborn escalators, which are quite long, you had to stand on both
sides. Everybody had to
stand,
yes.
Yeah, so no one could rush up and try to beat the crowd. And they did actually find, the results showed that you do get, the escalators have a greater capacity when you do this. You do get more people through quicker at a faster rate. But, you know,
it's weird.
Individuals were not happy to do it.
Yeah, so they've tried to do that ad hoc at Oxford Circus. The thing that's been driving me mad, or did at the beginning, is Oxford Circus, they just no longer operate two of the escalators at rush hour.
Yeah, and it's like overcrowding on the platform.
Yeah, but when I didn't know this at first, and I got on the escalator, and once you're on, you can't get off because there's like 1,000 people in front of you, 1,000 people behind, and I'm 7 months pregnant, and it was one of the hottest days of the year. I was like, how could you trick me into getting on this evil contraption, this non-moving device?
That maybe you should have had some green paint.
Maybe I should have had,
yeah,
I didn't have a go line.
Yeah, well, we'll see how the trial goes later this year. Hopefully there might be some results that they publish, or we can follow up and try and see if it actually did make a difference. And Vicky might let us know if it made a difference to her commute when it goes wrong. But moving from something that is meant to keep people possibly a bit safer to a incident this week, or well, some research that showed robots can be hacked, which isn't itself necessarily a huge surprise because anything connected to the internet can pretty much be hacked. But earlier this year, a company, a security research company called IOActive, released a report stating, well, it was called Hacking Robots Before Skynet, which is pretty dramatic as a as an opening.
When are we going to stop making the Skynet comparison? I mean,
I don't think it'll ever happen. Along with the stories talking about artificial intelligence, where it's a robot that is like a ghostly, like, Terminator thing.
Yeah, can we just like agree not to ever compare real robots to Terminator ever again?
Okay, that's agreed. We've sorted that out.
Wired policy.
Yeah, we're done. And everybody else can follow that as well, I think.
Yeah.
But in this research, the humans who were looking at the robots, they decided to look at some of the robots that are big, coming into our houses and workplaces a little bit. So these are mostly the humanoid white plastic things with giant googly eyes,
like,
and that
Pepper.
The Pepper was one of them. There was a few others from different companies as well, but they're all robots that are billed as sort of collaborative assistants, things to help humans out, and sort of the adverts for them show them doing yoga, speaking to people.
Oh, that's helpful.
Yeah.
Doing yoga.
Companion robots. So they looked at these earlier this year, but they actually didn't... they said that they could hack them, but they didn't reveal some of the specifics around what they could actually achieve and what they could make these robots do, because they were still... because they're ethical hackers, white hat hackers, researchers, they were speaking to the companies who created these robots to tell them there's a flaw in them and that there's security problems. So they've spoken to those companies now. We'll come on to their responses a little bit later, but they've actually released some videos and some details around the research of what the robots were doing.
So the headline one is...
yeah.
A stabbing robot.
Don't bury the lead.
Yeah, I sort of played that down a little bit there. But the main robot, there is a video of it holding a screwdriver and stabbing a tomato, like, multiple times. This tomato doesn't come well out of this incident. But the researchers were able to...
Unless you're making passata.
Yeah, that's...
Useful robot.
Yeah.
I don't think they were doing that in this case.
Not
but,
a chef robot.
Do you cut your vegetables with a screwdriver?
No, but, you know, that might... You stamp on grapes. This might be a new technique. I don't know.
Probably not going to catch on. But what was shown in this video was this robot holding a screwdriver, which it's actually shown in one of the company's promotional videos. In their videos, it shows this little robot passing somebody who's under a sink a screwdriver, which could be helpful.
No, there is no plumber in the world who's going to allow a robot now to be its assistant.
No.
That mental image of lying under the sink, can't see it. Just hand me.
Yeah, it's probably not
stabby, stabby.
That's probably not going
to
catch on.
I mean, I have to say, we're talking about this stabbing robot as if it is genuinely a threatening thing. If you see the video,
yeah, it's not going to attack anybody. This robot's probably not even as high as...
it's like the cutest little thing.
Yeah, it's like knee height, maybe.
Vicky, have you not learned anything from all sci-fi movies? That's how they get you.
The Gremlins.
Yeah. Oh, we're so cute. Stabby, stabby. But, oh, it was an accident.
Yeah, you could probably knock this robot over with, like, one finger if you had to. But the point that the researchers were making is that these robots can actually still be... they can be tampered with. There's security vulnerabilities in them. Another one that they found some problems with was, like, a giant arm that works in some factories next to people and passes them components and parts, which could actually be
actually
a bit
scary.
More...
yeah, yeah. That sounds a bit more threatening.
Yeah, they actually... within that robot, they could... it had, like, it could... I can't remember the exact number, but it can exert a huge amount of force that could actually sort of injure somebody quite badly. But the point was that these companies that were building these robots weren't actually really taking much care around the security
nice.
Protocols of them. There were they called these hacks pretty much like really basic things. There wasn't sort of authentication on the person who could log into the robots, so they weren't really checking with proper passwords or systems like that. It was a bit different for each of the robots, but the researchers that I spoke to said that they weren't really that sophisticated, the attacks that they were doing.
Or the companies are purposefully introducing vulnerabilities in order to justify removing the human element of their business. Think about it.
we will.
Yeah, you need to stop reading the conspiracy theory websites.
That's such a good economic model.
It could, but maybe not good.
It's not safe for the people. We'll move you to the back office. Oh, the back office is closed. Oh, blah, blah, blah. Robots take over everything.
It could be part of a big plot, but I don't think so. I think it's probably just human error or not thinking about it in the coding process.
Human error. You've just fallen into their trap they set for you.
But most the researchers said that actually when they spoke to these companies, they weren't actually that responsive either. That since the stories have been published, the companies sort of in the comments they provided to us said some of the research was a bit over-exaggerated. Stabby robot is probably one of them. But the others said they were aware of the reports and sort of had fixed some of the problems. But the researchers said when they went to these and reported the problems initially, they didn't have that much of a great like comeback and say they didn't seem that concerned. So I think the point that you take away from this is all these sorts of systems may not be as secure as we would like to think they are. And if you're taking a robot into your home, maybe be aware that if it's not secure, somebody could hack its camera and watch you doing whatever you do in your home.
This is what Musk and everyone and Hawking have been telling us. We need a global standard, some kind of regulation so that we're not all stabbed in our kitchens by well-meaning robots.
Yeah, there was actually Elon Musk and a few other people from the world of science and technology wrote to the UN this week to say that killer robots should be banned.
I feel like they've written this
I don't think
every
they
year
this one
for the last
mind.
Few years. Yeah.
No, they weren't thinking about the little stabby
they're thinking
one.
Of
but
drones and
that
such
was,
like
that was
AI.
A separate like war robotics side of things. But still, killer robots, stabby robots, they're here. People just need to think about them seriously.
Statistically, you're more likely to be killed by a family member, right? We let robots in our homes, treat them like a family member. Why are you all looking at me like I'm crazy?
Just got very dark all of a sudden.
Be careful.
Should we move on?
You let in your home. Okay.
Leah, what have you been covering this week?
Safety check.
Yeah, there is a running theme of safety
there
through
is.
The podcast this week.
Danger. This isn't meant to be scaremongering. This is just a kind of speculative look at something Facebook's done this week. I think we're probably all quite familiar with their safety check feature. For anyone that doesn't know, Facebook lets you tell everyone in your network that you're safe in the event of a disaster. They've turned it on during terrorist attacks in the past, and they usually do it locally. So if something happens in London, you might get an alert in your feed saying, you know, let your friends and family know you're safe. So this week they announced that there's going to be a permanent safety check tab in the Facebook menu and a permanent page, which is basically like leads you to a newsfeed of doom and global disaster, if you like using that kind of thing. You know, there's probably also good positive elements that you can donate. There's probably easier channels to donate if you want to find out about things, and it's all kind of collated in this one place. But we were wondering if it's really such a great idea to have a social hub for the worst things happening on our planet at any given time, especially when it's kind of associated. The whole point of safety check is to check on your loved ones. So we kind of wondered if this is something that could tap into people's anxieties and really if it's like that healthy to have in a social network.
Mm. So that's been a criticism with safety check before, hasn't it? When, you know, they've been maybe overly broad with who they ask if you're safe. So, you know, when there was an attack in London, there were people in Manchester and places like that who, you know, were getting messages saying, your friends are, these friends have checked in as safe, but these ones haven't.
And you just panic and think, And it's silly because obviously people use Facebook to varying degrees. I never use safety check feature, but I don't post on Facebook that much. And then I have had panicked WhatsApps in the past saying like, are you okay? You haven't checked on Facebook. And I'm like, is this the global standard? Just give me a call. it's obviously a very, you know, well-meaning and a good thing in many respects. But I was reading around about social anxieties in the real world and how people that suffer from genuine, you know, serious debilitating anxieties, how they adapt to cope with that situation. And they have these safety behaviors that they use, which are essentially things like, so specifically for social anxiety, this is talking about things like avoiding eye contact, avoiding group meetings where you might have to speak. But, you know, they think this is a wonderful thing, makes them feel better, feels like they've got tools to deal with it. But repeatedly, there are tens of papers that you can find very easily from experimental psychologists showing that this is the worst thing you can do, and it makes your anxiety problem worse in the long term. You're basically reinforcing the idea that there's something there to be scared of in the first place. All those kind of physiological things that happen when you're panicking, they're going to happen anyway, and you're just going to associate the kind of protectionist behaviors with danger and threat. So you're kind of consolidating the fears. And I mean, this is obviously, like, there's no way you can say, oh, well, this happens with social anxiety, it will happen with this. It's only just been launched. You need to do a lot of research. But just as a kind of, just a little food for thought, apparently 18% of the population in the US suffer from anxiety. And if you extrapolate that figure out, that's 360 million people in Facebook's community if 18% suffered from anxiety. Again, obviously, this is just speculation. But, you know, potentially, you're kind of providing people with a place to tap into their worst fears at any given moment. And I don't know how you guys use Facebook on a day-to-day basis, but it's a habit for a lot of people. You have that kind of habitual clicking, not really that interested, mindlessly looking at it. And for someone with anxiety, social anxiety, it's already a problem with people suffering from social anxiety. But for kind of deeper rooted anxiety related to death and terrorism, which is a thing, it could be harmful. So yeah.
I guess the thing for me with safety check is, I think generally it's a good idea for when the situations arise where it's needed. Obviously, we would prefer if those situations never arose. That's the one. Got there eventually. But I think that you just don't necessarily need it there in a place that can be accessed all the time, I would say. That I would only really, like, if something happened local to me,
I wonder if
it's relevant
is,
and important, but I don't need to see it on the other side of the world when there's people I don't know necessarily.
I wonder if it's partly in response to criticism in the past of Facebook employing safety check in some cases and not in others.
Well, I did ask them all these things, and of course they didn't give me really an answer. They gave a very broad kind of, we want Facebook to be a safe community for everybody and for, you know, a global secure community, but it, very vague in Facebook's tendency to give comments like that. So, yeah, there has been a lot of criticism around it. Obviously, it's really valuable, but...
is it?
Well, some people, I think. Yeah. For some people,
I mean, I wonder
there are,
if
I'm
could...
sure there are such situations. Yeah. We've just not experienced them.
I wonder if it could also go in the opposite direction, though. If it's always there and it's covering everything all the time, could you kind of end up just becoming a bit
dead
immune
to it?
And, you know, you're not bothered by it anymore? So when... it could actually be a useful feature, you sort of
nobody's actually using it. I spoke to a clinical psychologist about this, and one of the things she said is that, you know, it could be just as ineffectual or damaging, depending how on the person, as, you know, the news we're inundated with, especially if you think of like BBC Live after a terrorist incident and all the kind of scaremonger it does. I mean, will it be any different from that? Will it kind of deaden us now? But I mean, she did say she didn't think it was far-fetched to have like quite significant implications for people's anxiety. Just in general, focusing on a threat may aggravate the perception of that threat, she was telling me. So, yeah, all in all, not really much point to it.
Yeah, it's a really complex, tricky thing to have in a social network in terms of how people respond to it and also its use cases. And it's very, as with many of the issues that Facebook and Twitter and big social network and Google and big social networks have faced recently, it's a lot more complex than just like this is right or wrong or it has a good impact or a bad impact, I think. And it's just one of these things that they have to sort of work out as they go along, yeah. Which isn't great at the time. But
then you can see problems almost arising, yeah. That their algorithm is going to prioritize certain events over others potentially and get it in real trouble when someone somewhere in the world is saying, how dare you forget about Papua New Guinea? I don't know. Why are you promoting this?
It's pretty complex.
And it's one of those weird services that you never, when social media first became a thing, I don't think anyone ever imagined these kind of tools. And then, they're introduced and you think, maybe this is a great idea. But then all these issues come along with them and you think, do we really want social networks to be getting involved in this area? On one hand, they've got this great reach. On the other hand, it's not really their strength.
Yeah, you feel like it should be
there. It's impossible, isn't it? They can't do it right or wrong.
No.
And I feel a bit bad, like, we'd be, people criticise them either way.
If they weren't doing something.
So, yeah.
I guess there are some nations that have really kind of resilient alert systems for things like earthquakes or terrorist incidents. I know in Israel there's like a national alert system for certain things. And, maybe it would be worthwhile. I don't know, maybe they did talk to these people, but you'd think it would be better to have an expert organisation that has a history in this creating it.
Yeah, well, I think it's one of these things.
Commercial enterprise.
If you've got any opinions, maybe let Liat know.
Let me know.
What's your Twitter or email?
My Twitter's at Liat Clark. Or Liat at wired.co.uk.
Yeah, so it's one of these issues that's difficult, but we're interested always to hear other people's thoughts on this. So let Liat know.
Yeah, I'd be interested to know if anyone's ever found it useful or found it really anti-useful.
Yeah, exactly. So get in touch if you have experience with this and have some thoughts to share. But to end the show this week, we are doing a quiz. Don't sound excited all at once. And we're going back to what we were talking about at the beginning, the London Underground.
Yes.
The British institution as it is. And I've got some hopefully not too challenging questions. They probably are going to be too difficult, but let's see how we do. So not an easy one to start off with, I would say. God. But how many, roughly,
I don't know.
Annual passengers are there on the London Underground? We're talking
here. Yeah.
We're thinking tourists. There's 8 million people that live in London anyway. So the annual
unique passengers or single
annual
trips?
Passenger numbers is the.
That's going to be enormous. I couldn't even begin. Ugh, Vicky's always really good at the number ones. I'm just going to wait for her to give an answer.
Oh, 500 million.
Liat.
600 million.
Liat, you win by default. It's 1.37 billion.
Yeah, I mean, I did think that sounded low, 500 million, I'm scared of my number.
You know what? I thought that sounded low. And then I thought
8 million Londoners, just how many of those are using it daily, plus all those outsiders?
Oldgate Station. I'm not actually sure what line that's on. Is
Oldgate East is on the, is it pink or purple?
Yeah, Hammersmith and City. I think it's on the
Metropolitan?
Yeah.
I make it maybe the Circle? Who knows? Yeah. Well, glad that's not the question.
That's not the question. But underneath the station, there is something there that's been there quite a few hundred years. Any ideas what it is?
A secret bar for TfL officials.
We're talking it was what was there was left there in the 1600s.
Yeah. Oh. A crypt.
1600s.
A wine cellar.
The remains of, I don't know.
You're both pretty much there in some ways.
Are we?
It's apparently one of the plague pits from obviously that time.
Said remains.
Yeah, and Vicky said a crypt, so.
And a wine cellar.
I know, that's why. Wine cellar, plague.
There are, about 1,000 bodies apparently under the station somewhere that have been there since around 1665, which is.
So they knew about it, they saw it, they thought, we'll build on top of that.
They were probably buried a long way underground,
when
I guess,
by then.
Did they
find this out? Now I'm questioning you.
Yeah, I don't know anything beyond the question.
You don't know anything beyond what you've written down.
We can cure the plague now anyway, can't we? So.
Yeah, so it won't happen
fine.
Again.
It's fine.
In 2001, London Underground introduced something called Madeline, or Madeline, however you want to pronounce it, to three stations, St James's Park, Euston and Piccadilly Circus. It didn't last very long. What was it?
Something about forming a line. I have no idea. Madeline.
And it's actually it's based on something that is used on the Paris Metro as well.
St James's Park, Euston and Piccadilly.
Yeah, there's nothing really in the...
Oh, there's nothing to do with the locations.
I'm trying to think of the Paris Metro. They have door exit doors, whereas the Tube does... No, the Tube does.
It was only a temporary thing that didn't last. They couldn't... It didn't please people in some ways.
Music.
No, it is sensory.
Joviality. Oh,
okay.
More instructions of where to... No.
There's still artworks around, so...
Now, I'm going to put you out your misery. It was a fragrance. They applied
God.
A fragrance to the floors to make them stop smelling so pungent, really. And it was described as a fresh, watery, floral bouquet of roses.
That's hilarious. That Londoners were like, screw you, I just want a lower fare and the trains to run on time.
And the Paris Metro stinks and not as roses.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
do you
apparently
know
it's
what happened? Why it was cut?
According to the article that I read, it didn't smell very nice. So people weren't... And it was only a trial as well, so they didn't take it on
that
from there.
That is hilarious. Madeline.
I'm going to try and do another abstract one here. If I were to put the emoji of a shower and a toilet next to each other, what station would I be describing?
Oh. Waterloo.
Yes.
Oh, that's so good.
That was probably a little bit easy, fun. But I didn't know if that visually worked so
it
well.
It did. It worked very well.
Next one. There are 217 stations
emojis.
Across the network. No more emojis. 270 stations across the network. What is the record time for getting around all of them? Like, from just a person setting out to go from... Just literally
every single
one in a row.
Station.
Yeah. And these lines run quite a long way. We're talking hours here. Yeah. Not.
Do they have to get off at each station?
I think they do.
Well, you'd have to change.
Yeah, but you could just...
Oh, wait, to get off? No, you just like on the platform, back on again. No.
Yeah, you don't have to spend much time there,
okay.
I don't think.
No, but if you think about...
I don't know why I bothered asking. It's not going to help me get to the answer. Because, well, there's the added thing here that the stations far out don't
you're gonna have to
stay
go all the
open
way to the...
very late.
Oh, wait a minute. So is it like they had to do it in one continuous
yes, it was
ride?
All in one go, the
so
quickest time to go
one
to
day.
Oh, so they
so
can't
it must have
done
been
done
in
it
under
over...
24 hours.
No, yeah. Well, in fact, can you tell us if it's pre or post night tube, Matt?
It's pre night tube.
Well, there you go. So you have to, it has to be under, when does the night tube? When did the tube used to stop running? Like
let's
11, 12?
Say, yeah, about midnight. So 5 a.m. till about midnight. So that gives us a maximum of...
I don't know when it starts. 18
like
hours?
Like 19 hours.
Yeah.
So
you say 19, I'll say 18. It has to be near the maximum. I can't believe anyone can do it in that time.
I'm going to say 16.
Oh, 17.
16 is close. 15 hours and 45 minutes.
That was really close.
That's, yeah. I can't
a couple of guys went between all the stations. This is a long-running record that people have brought down. It's actually changed based on the amount of stations there are as well. Apparently, there used to be 275 stations. Now there's 270.
You said a couple guys did it.
Yeah, they did it together. AJ, that's his full name, apparently, and Steve Wilson from the UK. Final question. When
I can't get over this.
When one line opened in 1884, the Times of London, the paper of record, described it as a form of mild torture which no person would undergo if he could conveniently help it.
Ugh.
What line do you think
about
it was?
A lot of stations. I mean, King's Cross comes to mind.
We're talking a whole line here.
Oh, the whole line.
Northern line.
It's one of the most hated, but it's not my most hated.
One reason I really dislike it is because I always end up getting on the wrong leg. Because it's the only one that has,
it branches
but,
off Charing Cross.
Yeah, it has
line.
Different branches and you
oh,
end up going
like
via Bank or via Charing Cross.
Ugh.
I mean, just make two different coloured lines. That's the point. If you're listening out there, London Underground.
Hundreds of years later, they're going to amend it.
So that's my guess.
Have you just gone with your own hated line?
Basically.
For me, my own hated line is between the District line and the Central line. For differing reasons. I think you might be right about northern. I'm going to go central because it's like, it feels like you're in the pits of hell. It's so deep underground.
The Times was describing the Circle Line.
Oh, Circle. I had that, didn't I? No, I said district.
I think the Circle's all right. What, do we know why?
I don't know any more than that. That's
It's so slow. You sit outside Edgware Road for like 20 minutes.
It probably would have been very different back in 1884
as
well.
Yeah, it's quite hard to tell.
Did the Northern Line exist then? Because maybe they just didn't know what they had in store for them.
Line's quite modern. And it's really fast, so people love it. But it's, I swear, it's deeper underground than the rest of them.
Effectively, their statement could probably apply to any of the lines. I think that's all we've got time for this week. You can read about all the stories that we've talked about on wire.co.uk. You can buy the magazine, that's still out now. And we will speak to you again next week.
Bye.